So walking meditation is really a bridge to bringing mindfulness to everyday activities. I was just telling somebody here, back to Upandita Sayadaw for a moment. In the 1984 retreat that we did with him in Barrie, that three-month retreat, another routine that he got into was, as we were seeing him 6 days a week for these interviews, we were asked to be very direct and specific about one walking period and one sitting period we'd had since we'd last seen him. So that, it didn't have to be excruciatingly detailed, but it was something like, you know, I sat down, I got very sleepy, sleepiness dissipated quickly, I became really restless, whatever it was, so that he had some actual information about our experience. So most of us would, at the end of one sitting and one walking, would take brief notes, just so we'd have that. So he and I got into this routine where I would go in to see him for my interview, and before I could read my notes and say anything about my sitting and my walking, he would say to me, "Tell me everything you noticed when you drank a cup of tea," which was nothing. So I left, and I'd sit as mindfully as I could. I'd walk as mindfully as I could, and when I drank that cup of tea, I'd feel the warmth of the teacup. I'd smell the tea. I'd taste the tea as I drank it. And then I went in to see him the next day. And before I could say anything, he would say, "Tell me everything you noticed when you washed your face," which was nothing. So out the door. And I'd sit and I'd walk as mindfully as I could, and I'd drink tea as mindfully as I could, in case he went back to that. And then when I was washing my face, I'd feel my hands in the water, and I'd feel the water on my face, and I'd come in the next day, and he would say, "Tell me everything you noticed when you took off your shoes," which was nothing. And I'd leave, and I'd add another activity to my realm of mindfulness, and I quickly saw where things were going, and in my mind, I called it the torment of continuity. But in reality, it was a wonderful experience, because everything could be an act of meditation. And even just those simple things like feel your hands in water, it's like very ordinary, kind of boring experience, just pops, it just comes alive as we experience the nuance of that tactile sensation. So it was fun. And some of that tremendous judgment we could get into, like if you're sitting in the dining room having a cup of tea on a retreat and you get lost in some tremendous fantasy and really swept away, when you realize it, our temptation is often to think, "Oh, I'd better throw this cup in the dishwasher and run back to the meditation hall so I could sit down and be mindful." But instead, you had to begin again right there. Keep drinking the cup of tea. Feel your feet against the ground. That's the moment. So the renewal, the beginning again, happens right in that moment with that view of mindfulness. And so walking is, of course, it's a practice in and of itself, but it's also serving us as a bridge to any activity that we might want to infuse with more mindfulness. So do you have any questions at all? We have microphones. I think. Yep. We have one microphone, which I'd really appreciate your using. If you can. A lot of people just don't like it. It's interesting, huh? But if you could bring yourself to, that would be helpful, and you may have to experiment with how close to hold it. Any comments, questions? Doesn't have to be a question, whatever you'd like to talk about.
Yeah,
Alex is in charge.
When I was sitting, is this on? Or? Is that okay? It looks like it's on, but it's not.
Okay, well, I can hear.
When I was sitting, I realised that normally when I come back sort of reflexly, and I sort of then almost take myself back to what I'd been lost on, to sort of really feel what it was, and then sort of there was a natural letting go of that, and then coming back and I said, no, this is working quite well. And then when I was doing the walking, I was trying to do the same thing, and then I found I was what was coming up was harder to let go of. And when I paid, it was sort of swelling, increasing rather than there being such a natural thing. I was stopping every time, and then I found most of the time I was stopping when I was walking. And I just wasn't sure where to practice the coming back to the original objects, or where to sort of really feel something else. Mm-hmm. And then, surely focusing more on yes, I can let go of this and let go of anything. Mm-hmm. And at what point is the paying attention? Increasing it because it's more dramatic than the feet, and there's a clinging to it because it's more intense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's see how I did. Did you hear that at all? Is there a no anywhere? Okay, thank you. Both in sitting and in walking, there's no real formula for when you want to come back to the breath, or the sensations. Some of it depends on what your intention is in that particular session. If we're trying to mostly practice concentration, or we feel unsettled, we feel uncertain, then usually we want to come back pretty quickly. Not harshly, but with some commitment. So, in the sitting, that might be the breath, as if that's what your primary object is, if that's what your home base is. And I actually once evolved my own meditation technique, which I'm about to share with you. This was early on in my meditation life. I was in India, and I was extremely judgmental. I was 18, I was pretty troubled, I had never really looked inside myself before all that much, and I was in a state of nearly constant shock and judgment, like, oh my God, I feel that, or that's terrible, or whatever. In fact, as an aside, I once, I met many of my people who are still my closest friends at that first retreat that I sat, and I'm somewhat famous amongst them for once having marched up to my first meditation teacher and looking him in the eye and saying, I never used to be an angry person before I started meditating, thereby laying claim to what I felt was true, that it was all his fault, But of course, I had been quite angry, I just had not been that in touch with it. So when I began sitting, it began coming up. So there's a lot happening, and I was very judgmental rather than being compassionate about it all. And I finally evolved because I was trying to stabilize some concentration. My mind was really unsteady. So I finally evolved this meditation technique of my own. We were working with mental noting, which I suggested somewhat with the breath. You could actually say in, out, if you want. And we were also asked to note, which is more a mindfulness technique, what whatever came up in a predominant fashion, an emotion, a thought, a sensation, just to quietly put a label on it, thinking, joy, sorrow, if the word comes easily, and we'll talk more about that as a technique. So I decided I was only going to have two mental labels. One was breath, the other was not breath. And it didn't matter if it was the most beautiful thought in the world or the most caustic, corrosive, nasty thought in the world, it was not the breath. And I'd see that, I'd label it, I'd let go, and I'd come back. And that was of huge help to me, because I didn't spend my time like thinking, oh my God, I can't believe I'm thinking this. Who would, you know, what if anyone finds out that's what I think and feel, and no one else is, you know, it was just like, it's not the breath. And then come back. And that's sort of the nature of concentration. We're not that interested in what else comes up besides the primary object. We just want to, let's see if we can let go and come back. Now, most of us, of course, add some measure of mindfulness to the concentration that we do, and that it can be blended in a lot of different ways. So one way is to start with the primary object, which might be the breath. Let lots of little blippy things come and go. But when something comes up with some intensity, so that it would be a little bit of a struggle to let go and bring your attention back to, say, the feeling of the breath, then we stay with that emotion or thought or sensation, whatever it is, for a very certain amount of time, small, I mean certain, like definite, but not endlessly, you know, for some short amount of time, that new object becomes the object of awareness. You're not trying to let go and bring your attention back to the breath, you're just with that in as open and mindful a way as you can be. Then you see if you can let go and come back. So that's the expansion upon the platform of concentration. So when you let go and try to come back, and that's what there's no formula for, it just doesn't happen that way, too bad. You know, it'd be nice to say three beats, you know, and then you're back. Remember that when we say we're with these different objects, it means with them in a certain way. Let's say it's anger that's arising, and it's quite strong. It feels like it would be sort of a struggle to let go and just come back to the breath. So then we turn our attention fully toward the anger. But that means the feeling of the anger, not trying to figure out what should I do about it. You know, maybe I'll do this vengeful thing and that vengeful thing, or I wouldn't be so prone to anger if I'd had a better childhood, and too bad, or I think I need a therapist. You know, I shouldn't have anger after all that money I spent in therapy, or I can't believe I've been practicing meditation for 40 years and anger still arises. What a waste of a life. It's actually a pivot that we do. So it's not why are we angry, is it right, is it wrong, but it's like, what does this feel like? Right? So we pivot toward the feeling itself. What does it feel like in my body? What's happening? What's the mood of anger? It's like we're watching the anger movie. And we look. If we look at the anger, very likely we will see layers of other feelings that are all kind of intertwined. We see sadness. We see fear, perhaps. We see helplessness. In Tibetan Buddhism, they say anger is that which we pick up when we feel weak because we think it's going to make us strong. So we see all of that as we look. And we see those things are always changing. That anger is a composite and that all those strands are coming and going. So that feeling that we once perhaps related to is so solid, so overwhelming, so congealing, so driving, we see is constantly changing. That's different. That way, anger, you know, if somebody stopped you on your way in here and asked you what would you like to feel today, you probably wouldn't check off anger. And you probably wouldn't check off fear, sadness, rage, you know, helplessness, all whirling together, and I'll call it anger. But the latter is an alive system. Once we see change, we see life. They're actually the same thing. So it's a very different relationship to the same old anger. That way the anger, as crummy as it is and as undesirable as it is, in a conventional sense, has now served as a vehicle for insight. So that's really mindful. So sitting is a little bit different than walking usually, because walking is just a more complex activity. And so the instruction actually is just what you said, to stop if something really strong is coming up that you can't just have be in the background or let go of as you return your attention to the sensations of movement, then the instruction is to stop and see if you can fully be with whatever it is. And then when it feels like it's time, you pick up the walking again. So there's nothing wrong with that. It's not better to be with your feet, or let's say it's an emotion, or the emotion is not worse. It's just a question of what's predominant. It's not necessarily that you're seeking intensity, but it's calling you in some way. But don't stay with it endlessly. You know, see if you can let go and come back to what's basically the baseline, which is those sensations. And we're here, you know, it's like, it's a little different than you're walking down the streets of London or someplace like that. Our biggest responsibility to ourselves and to one another is the cultivation of awareness and compassion. So it's okay. I was once walking behind with Upandita again, who seems to be here almost today so far, in 1984. Upandita once gave me an instruction where he said, if you do something physical in kind of a big way, like you're sitting in the dining room and you stand up without having left some space to notice, if you can notice, the intention to stand up, which is said to precede the action. He said, so if you say stand up in the dining room and you haven't left a space to see if you could feel that kind of spark of intention, sit down again. And then do it again. And I thought, yeah, right, that's what I'm going to do in the dining room, is stand up, sit down, stand up, sit down. But you know what? It doesn't matter. That's what we're here for, right? It doesn't matter. Like, it's not like a public restaurant where you're standing up and sitting down. We're just trying to cultivate greater awareness and compassion. So if you're walking, you stop 50,000 times, you know, it's okay. Anybody else? We have this. I don't know where the microphone is.
It's a very short question. Can you pivot towards a thought in the same way?
Can you pivot toward a thought in the same way? Yes. Usually we don't try to, if the thought is quite fleeting, because thoughts are so much more ephemeral in a way. But if there is a pattern of thinking, you know, where it feels repetitive or it feels intense, if it feels oppressive in some way, it's very good to pivot to it. Sometimes we just watch the thinking itself, seeing how one thought leads to the next. Sometimes we might add other components. So, for example, when I was, I went to India through school, as many of you know, I was in college, and it was basically my junior year abroad. And I was going to school in this city in New York State, which is said to have the worst weather in all of the United States, which I think is true. So many people, this was an independent study program for one's third year, many people applied to go some other place for a year, and then you're supposed to come back for your final year, and many people went and not that many people came back. So I did not hurry back, actually, myself. So I did end up coming back and finishing school and then going right back to India, but there was a period in there where I decided I was going to live in India for the rest of my life. And that's, I was incredibly changed, I was very happy, that was how things were going to be. So when, and it was quite difficult in those days to get an extended visa. So I would sit in meditation, and instead of paying attention to anything, I would just be thinking, let's see, next year when I need a visa extension, maybe I'll go there because that office, that visa office is very close and they'll be very sympathetic to meditators. And then, you know, maybe I have to go home briefly and finish school. But then when I come back the year after that, I'll get a visa extension over there because that's much more remote and no one ever goes there. And then the year after that, when I need a visa extension, I'll go over there because I heard those people are corrupt and I'll bribe them. And then the year after that, and then the bell would ring, and I'd get up, and when I came back, I'd have to do it all over again. Let's see, next year when I need a visa extension, I'll go over there, and then I'll go over there, and then I'll go to different places, you know. So I did like this incredible travelogue of India, sitting after sitting. And then I did two things that were very useful. One was, I said to myself, and this is what I mean by sometimes it's we look at other elements besides the thought. I asked myself, what are you feeling right now? What are you feeling right now? Because there was so much anxiety and so much yearning, so much longing, so much uncertainty I would get what I wanted, that that was driving just this repetitive kind of thinking. And I could have traveled around India in my mind forever. And I needed to drop to another level, which was really look at what I was feeling. And so that was really useful. And then the other thing I did that was very useful was I said to myself, you're not even really in India while you're in India. All you're doing is thinking about how to stay in India. Why not be in India when you're in India? Which was an incredibly useful piece of advice because, in fact, as my life evolved, you know, clearly I didn't spend the rest of my life living in India. I've gone back or I've gone back to other countries as a student, but it didn't work out that way. And I think it would be absolutely tragic if I look back on those years I had in India and reflected, wow, I spent nearly my whole time in my mind in a visa office and I never really experienced it. That would be awful. Instead, I think I can honestly say that of all the kind of phases and experiences I've had in my life, that was a time that was maybe most fully lived because I was practicing that, just that. You know, so we watch the nature of thoughts and we also watch what propels that kind of thinking, and but not trying to figure it out necessarily. You know, it's really through direct observation that the learning happens. Microphone.
Thanks. What was I going to ask? The moment. What I've been doing in my practice recently is particularly watching that moment of coming back, and I really became aware, it was particularly a couple of scenes I did with London Insight around compassion and metta practice and the importance of that, because it formally doing it often got lost with me in practice, and it really awakened that to me, and it became really noticeable to me in that moment of waking up, of, oh, there we are, it's so easy for me to slip into judgment. Oh, God, there I am again, frustration arising, all of those kind of things, and to actually re-center with the quality of metta at that point as well. So it seemed to me to be a part of the sort of step that I was formally introducing into my practice, that when I would come to that point, to do it with a real quality of compassion for what was going on.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful, and it's the trajectory. I think it's essential, actually, because I think we don't tend to so easily begin again. And I don't think we can do it without a greater development of loving kindness and compassion. It's like the secret ingredient in there. And there are, of course, several ways of developing more loving kindness and compassion. I think it does happen in a sneaky kind of way just from letting go and beginning again, because we see the frustration. We hear how we speak to ourselves. You know, we hear how much impatience there can be and unkindness, and we just loosen the grip of it. It's not that it never arises, but it doesn't become so, we don't take it so to heart. Like, yes, I'm horrible. But rather, just letting go, it is part of that, like exercising the letting go muscle, you know? We just come back more and more gracefully. And certainly I believe in the power and the efficacy of loving kindness practice, you know, which we'll do this afternoon, or begin this afternoon. It's really, it's a tremendous practice that has great effect. Like any practice, you know, not every practice is for everybody. And you may or may not resonate more strongly with certain practices, and that's certainly fine, but it's an interesting experiment, I think, to include loving kindness practice and check it out, you know, see what it does.
Is that okay? I find that sometimes when my mind is tired or focused, and I sit down to meditate, that instead of focusing on one thing, i.e. breath or sensation or sounds or thoughts or feelings or whatever, it starts to scatter about and it will latch onto sounds, and then it will wander off into something else, and then I'll catch it, and then I'll bring it back to sensation, and then it will wander off thinking about next week, and then I'll catch it, and I'll bring it back to breath, and then it will wander off, and so on and so on. Now, do you feel that it's better in those circumstances when one's mind is tired to concentrate on intention, or allow it to wander to those different places and concentrate instead on bringing it back in?
When you say intention, what do you mean?
Oh, you should I stick to a program?
Okay.
Let's stick with a sound, or let's stick with a
program. In a way, it's up to you. If it were me in that state, which it certainly can be, I would say it's more useful. I have found, but that's the experiment. You know, I found that usually it's more useful for me to have a program, to have a structure, not to feel imprisoned by it, but I'm very supported by structure. Because I see I have a big tendency to just dither, you know? Like, what I would more likely do in that situation is add a lot of, gee, would it be better to listen to sound? Or maybe I should be with the breath. I don't know, let me try the breath. No, that doesn't seem to be working. How about metta? I mean, really, you know? You'd think I would just go back to metta after all, you know? Oh, no, maybe not. You know, maybe I should, my first practice was the breath. So, you know, so I would add a lot of that, which tends to be really even more tiring and kind of demoralizing. So for me to basically sit down and know, okay, this is my program for this particular sitting. And again, it's not to be imprisoned by it, but to generally have that sense of structure is very useful. I mean, but it doesn't mean it's wrong to do the other. It's just you have to see how it works for you. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the kind of the thing about balance, which is intriguing. When we say that we're cultivating the ground so that certain qualities, certain things can emerge, like compassion, clarity, wisdom. Another way that's sometimes said is that rather than trying to grab from one of those, like, you know, how can I measure how much more compassionate I am by tonight, having spent a day pondering it? The belief is that if we can bring our system into greater balance, that compassion will emerge. And there are also ways we explore compassion that are very compelling, or any of these states. We explore balance that are very compelling, like what does it mean to have compassion for yourself and compassion for someone else? What does it mean to have compassion for someone and a very firm understanding that you don't want to give in to their entreaty, that that's just wrong? What does it mean to have compassion for somebody and also have the wisdom that you can't fix it for them, that that's not the nature of the universe? You know, there are all kinds of ways we explore balance experientially, you know, not necessarily analytically. And balance is not a static thing. It looks different at different times. So in an immediate sense, in anyone's practice, we're aiming toward balance. If your tendency is to try too hard and you get all stressed out, you know, balance is like, okay, relax a little bit. Like when I was first practicing, sometimes I described my early practice, not earliest, but soon after that, where as contemptuous as I was of the instruction, which was sit down, feel your breath, I thought it was too simplistic. Wasn't that easy to do? And one reason it wasn't that easy to do, I saw, with some growing awareness, I saw that almost as soon as this breath was beginning, I would find myself kind of mentally leaning forward to get ready for the next 50. And I realized that that wasn't just because I was sitting in a funny posture on the floor in India. That was very much my mental habit. I was very frightened, I was very wary, I was very guarded. I didn't know what might happen next. A lot had already happened to me in my life. And I felt I had to be ready. So for me, balance in those times looked like settle back. Let the breath come to you. I used to say to myself, you're breathing anyway. All you need to do is feel it. Because I had so much performance anxiety, it's like I'd never done it before. I can do this right. So it was like, settle back. Let the breath come to you. You're breathing anyway. But of course, we might be way too far back, very distant, very cut off from our experience. And balance is going to look a whole other way. We need to come forward more. We need to connect more, take a greater interest in our experience. And this isn't analytical or strategic. It would be really painful to sit here. Am I too far forward? Am I too far back? What do I need to be? It's not like that. But sometimes, and we develop a greater intuition. Like, okay, just let it go. Just be at ease. You're breathing anyway. Or, whoa, I haven't cared about what the breath felt like in, you know, probably 3 hours. Let me, you know, what's the beginning of this breath like? What's the end of it? What's it like as you breathe out? You know, so take more of an interest. And we just know. We develop that kind of intuition. And we can respond to it. It's like, I know structure really helps me. But that doesn't mean always. And forever, you know, we stay in touch because balance is shifting. It's not always going to mean the same thing. And so it's a very, very alive process. We are actually going to break for lunch now.